presented by the American Petroleum Institute.
Everyone needs a lawyer, even the President of the United States. And if you've been a Democrat in the White House over the last 30 years, Bob Bauer has, in some capacity, been your guy. Currently, Bauer is President Joe Biden's personal lawyer. Prior to that, he was general counsel for both of Barack Obama's presidential campaigns and Obama's White House counsel. He also served as counsel to Senate Democrats during Bill Clinton's impeachment trial. And in 2000, he was the top lawyer for New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley's presidential primary campaign against Al Gore. It was in that campaign that Bauer first became an expert in a unique political art, playing the role of his candidate's rival during debate prep. In 2020, he helped Biden prepare for debates by playing Bernie Sanders in the primaries and Donald Trump in the general election. It was his job to insult and impugn Biden the way that Trump would.
In all of the debate preps, and whether it was the Trump debate prep or Gore Bradley or others that I've done, you cannot be afraid of laying down on the table something that your candidate that you're preparing this for won't like.
With the first presidential debate less than 1 week away, and both Biden and Trump cramming to prepare for it, I wanted Bauer to come on and help us preview the big event. Bauer also has a new book out, The Unraveling, Reflections on Politics Without Ethics and Democracy in Crisis, which is an account of his accumulated wisdom in decades of work at the highest levels of American politics and government. Bauer and I met downtown in Washington on Thursday afternoon and discussed what it's like to prepare Biden for a Trump debate, whether or not Democratic prosecutors have overdone it on pursuing legal actions against Trump, whether his book is going to get him in trouble with his number one client, President Joe Biden, and a lot more. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Since it's a week out from the debates, and you've got at least a partial chapter on debates, and you have been deeply involved with presidential debates in many ways, let's talk about debates. Let's start with this fun one. In 2020, tell everyone how you prepared to play Donald Trump in the Biden debate prep.
Certainly. Well, first of all, let me be clear. I haven't only done Donald Trump in debate prep. I've done others in debate prep.
You've done Bernie. You've done Gore.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly.
Let's start with Trump, though.
Yeah. No doubt, start with Trump. But in all of those cases, literally without exception, there are, I wouldn't say the two overriding objectives, one and two, but the principal objectives are, first of all, to approximate as closely as you possibly can how it is that that individual, the opponent, is going to debate. What arguments are going to be made and how are they going to be made? What's going to happen on that stage as those arguments are presented in front of an audience? That doesn't mean high theater. This is not a Saturday Night Live impression. You don't want to detract from the serious business of prepping the candidate. But
did you
have
dress
to
up as Trump?
No.
You didn't do
that? I didn't dress up as any of the candidates that I prepped.
Although this is audio only, but you probably look the most similar to Bernie of those three.
Well, thank you. He and I are close in age, so I don't. That's absolutely fine. But it's not a impression in the theatrical sense.
Got it.
But it is an attempt to capture how those arguments are going to be made. And so in order to do that, number two, you have to immerse yourself in a huge amount of material so that you don't wind up, if you will, offering, for example, for a Republican candidate or a Democratic primary opponent, an argument that they might conceivably make, but they never did.
Right. You have a good example of this in the book on abortion and Trump.
Correct. Now, as I also mentioned, it was prescient.
But at the time.
But at the time, it was incorrect.
Explain what it is.
Yes. At the time, I had Trump, in effect, calling for the reversal of Roe versus Wade.
In debate prep with Biden.
Correct. And he hadn't. And Ron Klain detected that. And so in a break, he asked me, he was somewhat surprised, he said, has he gone that far? And I immediately realized he had not. Now, since then, he's talked about the great justices he's appointed and that this was the right decision. It turns it back to the states and so forth. But that was a mistake. You want to avoid those kinds of mistakes because you don't want the candidate preparing for an argument that the candidate's not going to hear, your candidate.
Must make it particularly difficult with Trump, considering he's a little less consistent on a lot of issues.
Well, he strikes, as many candidates do, and I mentioned this in the book, they wind up to greater or lesser degrees saying much of the same thing over long periods of time.
Interesting. So what did you learn about Trump studying him to that extent that you didn't realize before?
Well, you know, apart from the reserve I'm afraid I'm going to have to exhibit about Trump preparation here, I would say that I do not recall having been surprised by anything. By the time 2020 had rolled around, he'd been a presidential candidate and a president. And he's not somebody who shies away from the cameras, nor did he in his private life. And so there was a lot of Trump out there. And so very few surprises to be confronted.
You're playing Trump again for debate prep this time around. How is
it? I can't speak to
how is it different?
I can't speak to whether how debate prep is being organized this time around.
But so could you just tell us like a little bit of how it's different preparing for him this time versus last?
I'm afraid I can't go there.
Let's stick to 2020.
Okay.
Were there any instances in debate prep? You talk about it in the book where you it can be a little bit of a dangerous assignment playing the debate opponent because you have to really rattle, in this case, the former vice president, and you have to really piss them off. And did President Biden ever, any instances of like, will you shut up, man, or like get angry with you? Or are you not doing your job if that doesn't happen?
I'll answer this question with some sensitivity again to what I can talk about, what I can. I would say in all of the debate preps, and whether it was a Trump debate prep or Gore Bradley or others that I've done, you cannot be afraid of laying down on the table something that your candidate that you're preparing this for won't like. That could be something that's personally insulting. That's something that can be completely false about a policy position that they've taken. You once said, you once voted, I can't believe you did that. I talk about that, by the way, in the context of the Gore Bradley debate in Des Moines, where Al Gore took the position completely falsely.
You are still mad about this.
I'm not.
I covered this at the time. I know exactly what you were talking about.
Yes.
But I'd sort of forgotten until you brought it up.
Well, it was a singular example in at least Democratic primary politics, in my experience, of a campaign taking a position that was completely false and then alerted to it, not changing it, and just keeping going. Angry about it? No, at this distance, I'm not angry about it, but I certainly thought it was worth mentioning in that chapter because it was, again, an example, and this is one of the themes I try to address in the book, an example of where a hard-fought campaign in which there will be strong disagreements about how voting records are characterized or positions are characterized, and there'll be puffery directed toward the electorate, inflated claims about records, deflated claims about records, but there's still a line. There has to be a line.
And we'll get into this much more, but this is what the book is about, is where those lines are.
Yes, about keeping them in mind, caring about them, because in the aggregate, these choices that responsible actors make in politics and government, they also have an effect on democratic norms and practices and expectations. And everybody who's involved in this line of work, government or politics, has an ethical responsibility they simply cannot shake.
In the book, you criticize the Commission on Presidential Debates and reference the reforms proposed by this Annenberg Commission that you served on with, among others, Ron Klain and your wife, Anita Dunn, who works for the president, of course. What do you make of where CNN ended up with debate rules and format?
Again, I'm in the awkward position where I don't want to express an opinion that's confused with the official position of the campaign.
Yeah, you're speaking for yourself.
I can say in the book, I make it very clear how frustrated I was at the time. A frustration, by the way, I note that I shared during the Obama re-election campaign with Romney's general counsel, Ben Ginsburg.
That was interesting to learn that he approached you and wanted to do what you ended up doing this cycle.
Yes. It was less formal than a probe. He raised it with me just as a question. Why do we put up with this? I mean, why don't we simply work out what a good debate format would be? He would talk periodically about the beer tents and the party paraphernalia and ask, why in the world do we want any of that? And I didn't disagree with him, But there was not occasion, other reasons why at the time we were going to pursue a suggestion like that, and we didn't, and they didn't press it. So we went ahead under the commission's sponsorship. But I'm not very surprised that we ended up where we did, speaking purely for myself.
Okay.
Purely for myself. And I did address it in the book. The commission and the Annenberg report that we did, I think, reflected this view. The commission simply didn't adapt. I mean, it's a private organization. It's a 501c3. And so its influence lasts as long as it credibly performs that mission. And over time, with the candidates in particular, that credibility became quite strained. Not because the people on the commission are not good people and don't have the best interests of the country in mind. I know some of them, and they do. But I think it was doomed to obsolescence eventually.
You think that's where it is now? You think it's dead?
I don't know. But I mean, imagine just for one thing, and again, speaking only for myself, a press release is issued one day where the commission announces that the candidates are going to assemble in the following cities on the following dates. Really? I'm a general counsel campaign. I didn't know that. I'm supposed to be in St. Louis on, you know, September 17th at 7 p.m. Oh, well, thank you for letting me know. And those sorts of issues, number of debates, the fundamental formats of debates, the moderator selection, are ones that, you know, were being unilaterally sort of decided with very limited exceptions.
I did a show with Frank Fahrenkopf, so I'm going to put up what I think he would say here is those dates and places were chosen before the nominees were chosen. And everyone is invited to the debates. They're not, it's not Frank, it's not the CPD saying you must be here. It's an invitation. It's this commission that has established the dates and places. And of course, you're welcome to go or not. And you guys aren't going. So it wasn't, I don't think the press release says you have to show up. It's not a subpoena.
No, it is not a subpoena. But let me say this. I think that answer is graceful. That is to say, his answer to you is graceful, but
I'm making that up, but I think that's what he might say.
Okay. If he were to answer, I would say that's graceful, but somewhat disingenuous. The expectation, certainly in press circles, is that's when the presidential debates will take place. And the tradition commits the candidates to accepting. And if they don't accept, they're bucking a tradition that's critically important to the conduct of American democratic life. That is one answer I'd have. The other answer I'd have was, yes, of course it's before the nominees are picked, but it's directed toward the parties and their nominees, however they're eventually chosen or in whoever is eventually chosen. So I don't think that's a particularly compelling response.
All right, but here's what we have now, the CNN debate, which is going to be 90 minutes with commercials. I don't see how that's better than what Fahrenkopf was going to put on, a non-commercial event. It wasn't a sure thing that it would be simulcast and picked up by everyone else, which could have limited its distribution. I guess my question is, what's better about where we ended up in this with this CNN debate?
Well, speaking of some of the issues I covered in the Annenberg debate and the Annenberg report, let's start with it being a Kennedy-Nixon format without an audience. Let's take down the, if you will, politics of audience. That is to say, you know, the hooting and the endless effort on the part of moderators to warn the audience that they really need to be quiet and not create any kind of commotion. This is a serious format. It's a format in which the candidates can be heard, but they're the only ones who are heard. And they're performing for the country, not performing for a select audience, some of whom are fortunate enough to receive tickets to the event. So I think that is a very strong point in its favor.
Just from a strategic perspective, though, mm-hmm. is it this mic muting thing? One of the most memorable lines of the 2020 debate was when Trump was totally out of control, playing, I assume, a similar role that you played during debate prep. It was if you were prescient, and Biden, you know, had the famous, you know, "Will you shut up, man?" line, and everyone decided that Trump lost that debate because he kept interrupting over and over again. Wasn't that kind of an advantage for Biden that he will no longer have with this mic muting setup?
Well, as a student of the debates, here's how I would respond to you.
Yeah.
First of all, use the word lines. And there is a tendency to zero in on lines. It's a debate.
I understand where you're going with this, but okay. We usually zero in on a line that gets at something, a larger truth. So That's why I point out that line was emblematic of why people thought Biden did better than Trump.
Fair enough. But you also know people are looking for a moment, but a reportable moment that will replay virally and on cable, wherever. And what you are hoping for, ideally, is a debate that the public will watch, the electorate will watch, and it will be rich in exposing the competing views of these two candidates so that it's not sort of absorbed entirely into everyone watching for the moment.
Fair.
So that's one thing.
Fair.
I look at it that way. Secondly, again, and my point about audiences speaks to this, or at least my preference on the audience issue speaks to this. The competing mic syndrome is part and parcel of the sort of theatrics that I hope one could get away with from a debate. Having them sort of yell at each other, cut each other off.
Let me interrupt you. Do you think this conversation would be better if he was muting our mics?
If I was saying something you disagreed with and he muted your mic, I'd be fine with it.
Yeah, every time I asked a question, it would be question, mic, mute, and I couldn't interrupt you and you couldn't interrupt me.
But this is different. This is an interview. This is not a debate. And there's a whole set of objectives that are structured for a debate. They serve completely different purposes. I mean, why would I want you muted as you're asking questions that I don't like? You're having me muted as I'm giving you answers you don't like. That's not what this particular format, this particular exchange is designed to achieve.
I just think the danger is that you don't get a spontaneous exchange of ideas. The Nixon Kennedy debate, besides being known for the most superficial of reasons, Nixon's 5 o'clock shadow, was it wasn't really a debate. It was he says this, he says this. There was no interrupting. There was no real clash. So we sort of set things back 60 years here.
I don't know that we've set things back. I mean, the Kennedy-Nixon debate was considered a significant debate. Yes, it's true. There was a sort of back and forth about policy and Taiwan and the issues of the day being, if you will, sort of in each case showcased by the candidates and sort of one-on-one exchange.
Right.
That can happen. But there's still spontaneity because each candidate, when the time comes back to them to respond, has to make a decision about how to answer something that was misrepresented in their view on the other side or they hadn't heard before. So there is a requirement of doing more than just reading set speeches, which, by the way, isn't possible anyway because they can't bring written material with them to the podium. The spontaneity that I have in mind when I hear you use the term is something, again, I have to be honest, maybe not in your case, is informed by the press's desire for a gaffe. A slip up, a big moment that is used then to define the entire debate.
Yeah. One thing I found that was so interesting in the book is you, at one point towards the end, you give a list of all of the legal contingencies that the Biden planned for in 2020 and were incredibly prescient, all things that happened that were important to plan for. What would be on that list for 2024?
I think some of this is widely discussed, some of which, by the way, has been before the courts, like the question of whether state legislatures will act in some way to undermine electoral choice in their states as reflected in the certified results. There are obviously taking place right now challenges that have been filed by the Republican Party to have ballots disqualified for some technical reason to promote active challenging at the polls. But the law has also changed in a number of respects, and that has to be taken into account as you consider what kind of legal challenges one side or the other would file. So it has to be updated in light of changes in legal developments. But some of these fundamentals that I was talking about, those sorts of things in the name of securing the integrity of the election, protecting against fraud, track pretty much between 2020 and the present day. The attack may come from a different direction. The law may have changed that affects the attack, but the basics behind the attack are the same. Having said that, every campaign has to not rely on either the quality of its preparation the last time around or the success of its efforts in defending itself the last time around. It has to think, what in this period of time could be different? What are we seeing that suggests that it would be different?
Right, because so much of that was telegraphed in 2020.
Yes, yes. And some of it is even telegraphed today.
What's new on the horizon in terms of what you hear Republicans and Trump telegraphing?
Well, I want to draw a distinction for the moment between Trump campaign / Republican National Committee activity and what I would call other electional denialist or election integrity defense activity that you see that may be encouraged, but it's coming from other sources, again, sources of support for what the Republicans are claiming about elections.
Like the Steve Bannons of the world, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and different nonprofit organizations that show up and file suits, and different election officials now who make claims about their authority. I mean, we're seeing and have seen election officials saying, no, if I'm not satisfied with the outcome here, I may not certify. I'll just block it. And you saw that play out very dramatically in Michigan in 2020. That is something that we might see more of this time around. I wouldn't say, by the way, we're going to see it widely and across the board. If I could, and this is more than a footnote, at the same time as I'm active in the Biden campaign, and I discuss this in the book, I'm very active on bipartisan voting reform and election administration. I think that's really important. The two parties have to collaborate, if they can at all, to protect the system fundamentally and to defend it, and in particular, to stand up for professional election administration. And I will tell you that in the travels that I've done around the country recently in battleground states with Republicans, with Ben Ginsburg and others, I find a Republican as well as Democratic election officials who are really determined to do this the right way. But I just want to raise the point that, yes, there are going to be election officials who may be prepared to create trouble.
Is there anything preemptively that you do when you encounter public commentary from election officials that telegraph that?
Well, yes. I mean, there are things that you can do to lay down markers and certainly to respond quickly as soon as you hear that they're operating on that theory. And right now there is a legal case that is developed in Fulton County, Georgia, of precisely this kind, that involves both an election official who is insisting on, if you will, discretionary certification authority rather than the ministerial act has widely been accepted to be and should be under the law in just certifying the results that are reported up. And the state election board itself in a rulemaking may be, if you will, toying around with the authority the election officials have to refuse certification.
This is not the Trump racketeering case.
No.
This is a different Fulton County. This is a different Voting Court. But yeah.
Well, it's totally correct. By legal subject matter, it's totally unrelated, but you're correct. It's not topically unrelated. Yeah.
You write a lot about campaign finance reform in the book, and you have a very nuanced view of political reform. I found it really refreshing reading your views. You're very aware of unintended consequences when it comes to political reform, and you basically think that the history of campaign finance is a history of unintended consequences. And refreshingly, you say, I don't repent in terms of your skepticism. And I can't help but ask one more preface to this question. You talk about the famous John Edwards case, and you note that his political career ended in another sex scandal that became, foolishly, a criminal prosecution that did not move the jury. I can't help but notice your criticisms of campaign finance, of the Edwards case. It seems like you would be very, very skeptical of what of the Trump case in Manhattan when it comes to elevating those bookkeeping frauds to a campaign finance violation.
I bet you, Ryan, you know that I'm not going to address that question. But you did your job by asking it.
But surely Bob Bauer does not think that a private NDA should be a reportable campaign finance expense.
Well, I don't know that you framed the issue in the case correctly there.
All right, correct me. I'm not sure that's the issue in the case. Or the reimbursements.
For professional and representational reasons, my commenting on a case like that, which, by the way, is ongoing because the
no sentencing
Trump
yet.
Is appealing, would be inappropriate.
Why would it be inappropriate?
Because I don't want any confusion between the views that I express and the views that others that I'm involved with professionally might hold. I don't want someone to say, and you can imagine it. Oh, the Democrats, one of the Democrats' presidential campaign lawyers or Biden's lawyer has said this.
For nearly 4 years, the American people have faced the pain of high inflation and global conflict. Now, more than ever, it's time to end political gamesmanship and implement policies that help benefit Americans. Let's work together on solutions that help address the consequences of inflation and secure our energy future. Visit lightsonenergy.com/energyleadership to learn more.
In writing about this in the book, you note that one lesson you learned there was to ask for forgiveness rather than permission.
Yes.
When you're out there expressing your opinions.
Yes.
One, I think that that's the spirit with which we should have this conversation. but two, did you ask anyone about publishing this book?
No.
You didn't ask the president?
No.
You
just think he would have expected me to, but I don't know because I didn't ask.
Go ahead.
Let me be clear. I, after many, many years in private practice, and the vast majority of it, some 38 years, taking out some time for government work, spent at the same law firm, I left my law firm so that I could devote myself full time to the Legal Academy, and I'm at NYU Law.
Yeah.
And the reason was that I wanted to get away from being bound, if you will, in the expression of my views, any particular interest that I was thought to represent or be responsible for. Now, I made a fateful decision I don't regret in the least. I decided to maintain what I called a little pack of legacy clients with whom I had a close personal relationship, one of whom was Joe Biden, who I didn't know, decided to run for president and became president. And so that took that narrow band of representations and significantly expanded it. So I, in that respect, in that area of concern about what I say about matters that are directly relevant to his administration or to his campaign, I have to observe constraints. But other than that, I teach what I am going to teach and I write what I'm going to write. And of course, you say permission or rather forgiveness rather than permission. In writing this book, I was mindful there's an attorney-client privilege I want to respect, their client confidentiality that I want to respect. I have stories I would have loved to put in the book.
Well, sometimes you tell stories without the names.
Yes.
It's going to be a little frustrating.
Yeah. It's a bit of a – correct. I tried to be sensitive to the trust that people have reposed in me, I hope, as a lawyer. But I also don't want anyone to own a decision about what I write. And so, no, I wrote this book without seeking permission.
And just so people understand, you are not one of these Biden lifers. You met Biden via the working for the Obama campaign.
That's correct. I knew him before. I had met him when I was doing a lot of Senate legal work, campaign work. But I did not represent him at the time, and I didn't come to really know him or represent him personally until he became the vice presidential pick of President Obama.
The president has said that he would not pardon his son, Hunter Biden. But as someone who is a friend and advisor to the president, would you recommend that he do that, that he change his mind about that?
Your tenacity is impressive.
Well, we haven't even talked about this yet.
Especially because you're well aware that I'm not going to respond to a question like that, but I admire you for keeping on it.
All right. This one I am going to press you on because when you talk about the Hur investigation, you're – whole spiel on that is about why you couldn't talk about it in real time because you needed to protect the integrity of the investigation. Okay? That investigation is now over. You've written about it in the book. So I hope we can talk a little bit about that. And I'd like to start here with asking you what your reaction was upon reading the first draft of the Hur report.
To be sure, I want to be very clear. The only part of the book that deals with the Hur investigation was that issue that you just raised, press dissatisfaction with the level of transparency they thought had been provided by the administration. So I addressed that in a chapter on the press.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So I didn't otherwise discuss the classified documents investigation. It would have been entirely inappropriate for me to do so. I can track what I have said in letters that have been released as counsel, and I can just say generally that how would I put it? I obviously had major differences with the way the investigation went. I think it ended up legally, absolutely legally, where it had to end. I mean, it had to end the way it did because there was, in my judgment, no case to be made to the contrary, no matter how much somebody might stretch to make that case to the contrary. But as you know, and I've said this publicly, we wrote letters that have been released. We wrote letters to both Rob Herr and to the department that some of the editorializing that Rob Herr did in that report that I otherwise thought was not assembled very, in my judgment, effectively or well.
Assembled?
Meaning that I thought the report in a number of respects just did not meet my expectations for how it would be done. I mean, there's already a controversy about how much special counsel should say. As you recall, when these regulations were promulgated, the idea was to get away from the hundreds of pages that the so-called independent counsels from a prior era had produced and then generate what was essentially, and I'm almost quoting from the regulations, not quite, a limited confidential report to the Attorney General, who in turn would make a decision about what to release in the public interest. But the report received would focus on whether a case should be brought or declined, and it would be limited in character to that objective. And now we have these tomes that come out.
Mueller, Herr.
Absolutely.
So are we back?
Durham. Yes. And I think that's very regrettable. It's unfortunate. And by the way,
that extends to the Mueller case as well?
It is difficult as a process matter. As much as I think Bob Mueller was committed to writing Volume 1 to warn the American public about the extent of foreign government interference in our elections, to take the 400-page report that he produced and every aspect of it and say it conformed to what my expectations would have been of reports under the special counsel rules. But that's the report that he wrote, and that was the report the Attorney General, although as we know, Bill Barr reluctantly then passed on to the Congress and then released to the American public. And of course, in the hands of Bob Mueller, it might be very different than in the hands of somebody else.
Like
and
her.
So you can say, well, Bob Mueller's a professional. Well, or John Durham. Let's not forget John Durham, who
you'd probably
prosecuted.
It sounds like you would rank him down at the bottom of those three.
Well, let me just say something about that. I just think it's worth remembering this. And that is John Durham took two cases to trial and lost both of them almost instantly.
Yeah.
And yet he wrote 300 pages to vindicate, the position he'd taken all along was that there was some irregularity in this whole investigation of the connection between the Trump campaign and the Russians and so forth. But he took his main cases to trial and he lost them both, and he lost them like within a day or two.
Yeah.
And the jury came back and said, no go. And yet 300 plus pages, unedited, untouched by anybody else, went from John Durham to the world in connection with the whole business of trying to persuade people of his view, his political view, that the Department of Justice had been corrupted and people around the department had been corrupted to take after Donald Trump over this whole Russia allegation. And that's not how these regulations were expected to work. So colleague Jack – I'm sorry?
Do you think that her, a Trump appointee, was partisan in the way he pursued that case?
I don't want to characterize him in that way. I certainly think in many respects he was misguided, but I'm not going to say that he had a political agenda. I didn't have any indication that he had a political agenda. But the editorializing in the report was, first of all, in my view, flatly inconsistent with departmental guidelines for the way third parties are treated or in subjects who are not charged or third parties are treated in reports like that. And I truly do not understand it. There's so much political pressure. Under the independent counsel statute, it was thought to result in independent counsel investigations that never ended or that created pressures to prosecute. But it's gotten worse in this polarized politics that, as with Mueller, as with her, they know that they're being watched and that there's going to be blowback in Mueller's case from the left if he doesn't proceed, or from Democrats if he doesn't proceed against Donald Trump. In Bob Herr's case, Republicans were watching closely, but I'm not going to characterize his response. I don't think that would be fair.
Is there anything that you think you could have done differently that would have prevented the triggering of Garland appointing a special counsel in that case?
that I could have done?
Yeah. Is there anything in the sort of early?
I could have done, no.
Or that the president's team could have done, or that, you know, there was sort of this drip, drip, drip in the early days that eventually it seemed like Garland said, all right, well, we've got to appoint a special counsel here.
That's a decision the attorney general has to make, and I don't think that anybody can influence that outcome.
And just to follow up on what you were saying, I mean, it seems like the problem now, tell me if I've got this wrong, it sounds like one of the issues is one of the fixes going from the independent counsel to the special counsel was that the attorney general would exercise some control. You're nodding your head. Some control, some regulation, some enforcement. On the other hand, if Barr had been, you know, the extent of, I'm mixing up my attorney generals here, though. If Trump's attorney general had exercised too much control over Mueller, Democrats would have been apoplectic. And similarly with Merrick Garland, I think you and other Democrats, correct me if I'm wrong, would have, or Republicans, excuse me, would have been not happy with the Democratic president's attorney general meddling with the special counsel. But the whole point is that the attorney general was supposed to control the process more. Just unpack that for me.
No, you're quite right. If you recall, under the old independent counsel statute, with both parties were finally happy to see die, there was an odd arrangement that produced a famous dissent from Justice Scalia, but an odd arrangement under which the judiciary was involved in appointment and supervision. And it wasn't good and it wasn't good for the judiciary. That did not work out well at all, and it was ill-conceived in the first instance. So the notion was, let's return it to the Department of Justice and provide enough independence so that the public can have confidence in the special prosecutor's ability to escape any kind of political pressure. But let's not disturb the attorney general's role as head of the department and ensure that the attorney general has adequate opportunity and a conceded authority to learn about the investigation as it unfolds, to supervise it as appropriate. But every decision from whether the charges should be brought to the major investigative decisions are ones under the attorney general's supervision. But what happens? Special counsels are referred to as independent counsels.
Right.
The independent counsel mindset takes hold. The press reports it as a major sin if there is any possible involvement by DOJ in the supervision of the special counsel. And so it's all collapsed back into something that looks an awful lot like the independent counsel statute. One thought about what the Mueller prosecution team tried to do here was to inform not just the public debate, but perhaps the congressional debate about whether impeachment might be appropriate. But of course, one of the steps that was taken in the independent counsel repeal was to take away from somebody like a special counsel what the independent counsel previously had, which was the authority to actually report to the Congress that they had found evidence of potentially impeachable offenses. And that's what Ken started with Bill Clinton. He went to the Congress and said, I have found evidence of impeachable offenses. By the way, amazing as it is to think back, and became one of the lead witnesses for the Republican in the House impeachment proceeding.
Yeah. You were part of the legal team for the Senate Democrats.
That's correct. That's not the way things should go.
And he, of course, all of the evidence and witnesses were then turned over to Congress. In the fight over the Hur report, it's up to the attorney general. For instance, the president said he didn't want the audio recordings of his interview with the special counsel released to Congress. Was he able to do that under the independent counsel rule? Would he have been able to do that? Or it would have been up to the independent counsel, him or herself?
That is a good question, because I'm not sure in every application I have the answer off the top of my head.
Do you think that was the right decision, not to hand over the tapes?
Another question that you're asking me that goes to what I can't discuss.
I mean, why?
Or I can't express an opinion about something like that. That's not my call to make publicly. Whatever I have ever said on that topic is something I have to keep to myself.
All right. It's not in the book. So
imagine if I were your lawyer. Wouldn't you want me to be this circumspect? Of course you would.
There. All right. But this is something you write about, which I found really interesting, is that you were harshly critical of Democrats in 2022 supporting MAGA candidates in GOP primaries. You talk about how former Senator Claire McCaskill once bragged about in Politico magazine, I believe, pioneering that. It really became a thing in 2022. I remember a lot of Democrats, I remember a lot of political observers at the time saying, this didn't work out so well in 2016, when everyone wished Trump was the nominee. You think it's a bad idea?
I'm very troubled by it. By the way, I think very highly of Claire McCaskill on this. I have clearly a disagreement with her. I don't even know what she thinks about it at the present time. And she certainly is not the only one since then who, I mean, she. I haven't heard her express an opinion since then. Others have clearly acted on that basic theory.
Pelosi and Schumer, he was very important, you know, top Democratic officials in charge of the 2022 midterms who, gave the go ahead for that. It worked out. It worked in the midterms. Anyway, lay out your case of concern about it.
Let me just begin with a practical point, which is not an ethical point. The practical point is be careful what you wish for. And I just think it's a very dangerous game to play. The idea that you would spend money to persuade people to vote for someone you actually think is dangerous if they were to win office raises for me some significant questions. And then a concern that's related to that is it is fundamentally a concerted effort to spend money to deceive voters. And
explain that, because I don't think that is intuitive to a lot of political-minded listeners who listen to this. I think, like as you point out in the book, a lot of people just think, oh, that's smart.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
It's sort of a. But explain why it's dishonest.
It is an attempt to, how would you call, goad voters into voting for somebody that you are confident that should they care about this, they wouldn't vote for if they knew they couldn't win. In other words, you're saying to the voters, vote for this person, vote for Ryan Lizza because he's a true conservative, right? And they vote for Lyon Lizza. Maybe, by the way, they're also encouraged to see some of this coming if they know it's coming from Democrats because they think, why? If the Democrats think this is a true conservative, this must be a really true conservative.
Yeah, they're scared of him. So
right. We're scared. Exactly. And they're touting that candidate's bona fides as a conservative candidate. But what they're really trying to do is to have the voters focus on that without realizing that the game that's being played is to put the most beatable Republican candidate on the ticket. And as you know, in other contexts like micro-targeting, right, we have a significant issue with the manipulation, misinformation, disinformation, fake AI, various kinds of targeting practices with manipulating the electorate. Is this particular form that you and I are discussing, that kind of manipulation by which you try to persuade them that the candidate they really want and who's the most beatable is the candidate they should nominate. Is that at the moment, the example that we should most worry about? It is the most troubling of all the potential examples in that category? Maybe not, especially given deep fakes, AI. But I think it's worth really thinking hard about, and I am not a fan of it. I think what happens eventually is this all catches up to the political process because voters ultimately conclude that policy is a dirty business. The people that they expect to lead the country or who are vying to lead the country are constantly pulling the wool over their eyes. It's just filthy. It's a tough business. I'm all in favor of waging hard, tough campaigns. I'm all in favor of putting before the electorate a very tough characterization of your opposition, even if it's not a characterization that your opposition necessarily thinks is fair. I'm not worried about any of that, but there have to be some lines, or ultimately the process itself falls into discredit, and that's what we're dealing with right now.
What's interesting is when you're writing about these things, a recurring theme is you're obviously a Democrat and
yes,
want Democrats
so.
To win and mm-hmm. work for the
very
president
so.
And are playing Donald Trump in debate prep. I'm not going to get you to talk about that.
No,
anyway.
No, you're not going to get me to talk about it.
But you repeatedly express concern about things that you don't like on the Republican side being imported to the Democratic side. And the example we just talked about, that was something that the Democrats themselves are doing. What are the ones that concern you? What are the norm violations of the last 10 years that you worry that your own party might say, you know what, this is just how it's done now, and we need to do that? What are the ones that you want to tell Democrats, no, that's a line we should never cross?
So I don't.
The ones that are, that are legitimately on the table. Sure.
I don't know that I'm worried that Republican practices in the Trump era are being imported into the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is standing pretty strong against Trump politics. I'm not worried the Democrats are stepping away from that, but there is a kind of ends justifies the means mentality, particularly at a time of polarization and, if you will, an existential politics in which losing is unthinkable. There's a danger that unless we think hard about these practices and norms and what's required to keep them alive, some of these ends means resolutions are going to weaken. But I don't. I wouldn't look at the Democratic Party today and say, "Oh, I think they're heading the way of Donald Trump." I don't say that in the book.
There was one quote. This is one I wrote down, but I thought it was in several places. This was on the dangers of election denialism spreading. You write, "So in 2024, will Republicans supporting the Republican candidates?" I might have a typo here. Have a ready-made argument for rejecting the results of a lost election. So do their adversaries, who may make the case that the rules clamping down on voter access achieved their partisan goal, but made impossible acceptance of the results. That's what I was talking about when I.
Oh, I see. I see.
Criticisms of election denialism, concern that these tools, and that does happen in politics all the time, right? I mean, that one party does something and the other party says, all right, that's the way it is and we've got to do it.
Well, there's always this. Occasionally you hear this, you have to fight fire with fire and you can't unilaterally disarm. Listen,
the discussion you have about political scientists and militant democracy, in defense of democracy, some norms need to be put aside. Now, that's political scientists, but that's a debate that you mentioned in the book that people are having.
Yes, and if you put the norms to the side, then you have to be remarkably confident that you can get them back again. At some point, they lose their purchase. And so you have to think about ways of waging vigorous and successful campaigns, being as tough-minded as possible, but taking these concerns, particularly at a time of fragile democratic life, taking these concerns in mind as individual decisions are made about how you proceed. But I will say this. I reject the premise, I really do, that we have to be completely ends justifies the means minded to win.
This militant democracy argument, you're not there.
Pardon me?
The argument by some political scientists that you write about militant
democracy. I don't agree with it. And I also don't think, by the way, for somebody would come up to me and say, well, then you're dooming us to lose. And again, as I travel around the country, maybe there are Republicans who won't take to their soapbox and shout it loudly for fear of showing up, on viral media in an unfavorable light, being trolled. But I do think that there is a segment even of the Republican Party that may agree with what Donald Trump has to say about almost everything, taxes and regulations and wars overseas, you name it, but they don't agree with these norm-busting proclamations. They are intensely unhappy about what happened on January 6th. I think there's more of those Republicans than sometimes are heard because they're not the Republicans nowadays who are heard for just the reasons I suggested.
Of all of the political reforms that you have been writing about in recent years, if you had a magic wand, what's what's the one that you would implement?
Well, my focus in recent years, as you know, has been on executive branch reform. And Jack Goldsmith and I wrote a book called After Trump. And we have a reform organization that pursues reforms that are of the kind that we advocate for in the book. And I do think that there's a lot to be said about reform in any number of areas. But I think what I am most focused on is the very wrong place that the presidency has landed in. The presidency is an institution. It really requires reform. And yes, that runs up against this odd, conflicted American reaction to the presidency, which is on the one hand, adoring the presidents who hold the office, are superstars, the homes in which they were born become historic monuments immediately. They have massive libraries and museums that are built after they leave. And then, of course, on the other hand, the public can be very merciless toward them because the expectation of how they perform is so high, it can't be met, right? But there are other issues that we've seen about the extent to which the president is accountable under the rule of law, limited in the conduct of war powers, limited in the use of nuclear weapons, limited in the politicization of the Department of Justice. The whole question of whether presidents can conduct businesses and enrich themselves while in office, all of those issues remain unaddressed. And they need to be addressed. I mean, this institution is the one. I was asked the other day by a reporter, if the founders came back, what would they be most horrified by? I don't know that I can answer that question in any convincing detail, but the presidency would be close to the top of the lift.
The expansion of powers.
Where we have it. Yes, correct.
Do you think that Biden made a mistake by not addressing some of these political reforms? I mean, there's always this tension between reform and actually just passing, you know, your bread and butter agenda. Obama faced those same choices. He got the Electoral
Count Reform Act,
mm-hmm. which you were instrumental in term, which you were a major part of. Do you think he should have focused more on this kind of reform?
Well, if we go other close, you asked me a question that you're confident I won't answer.
All right. The real last question we do on this show every week is it's something proposed by our last guest.
Okay.
And then I want you to come up with a question for our next guest, and you don't know who that's going to be.
Oh, okay. A question for our next guest, and I don't know who it's going to be?
Nope. But your question comes from Jim Clyburn, and he did not know you were going to be on the show. And it is, what do you consider to be this nation's mission at this particular junction in its history?
The nation's mission at this junction in its history? Well, I'm going to have to say, and this is probably just a function of my being so deeply immersed in these issues in the writing of the book, I think our nation's mission is to recover a sense of our democratic culture.
What should we ask our next guest? It can really be anything.
Ask the next guest, do you agree with Bob Bauer about that?
Do you think Bob Bauer should have told a little bit more about debate prep last week?
That's fine. That's fine. No problem.
But you are playing Trump this time around, or did you get bumped? Did you get replaced?
You know, I can't address any questions relating to debate prep.
Bob, I really enjoyed the book. I hope people read it.
Thank you so much.
And I thank you for doing this.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rliza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.